Welcome to Proclaiming Christ, where we seek to encourage and stimulate preachers, teachers, and students of the Bible in their desire to see Christ preached and taught in all of Scripture. This is episode number 101. My name is Mark Winder, pastor of Wolf River Presbyterian Church in Collierville, Tennessee. Today, we will be looking at Genesis 29:19, all the way down to chapter 30 and verse 24. In an episode we've entitled Human Deception and Divine Operation. I've been joined today by Robert Arendale, who made his, debut, or what do you call it when you come back again after a previous stint, in episode 100. So welcome back to episode 101, Robert.
Hey, Mark. It's great to be back. Great to be with you today. And in particular, it is very good to be back in Genesis and looking at the patriarch Jacob. I believe we're right here, smack dab, almost in the middle of the story of Jacob. Why don't you catch us back up? Who is Jacob? Why is he important? And where are we gonna be going today?
Right. Well, back in episode 98, we looked at Jacob seeking his bride from the first half of Genesis 29, and we saw back there a number of parallels between the story of Jacob and the story of Isaac. But even more significantly, you know, we saw a number of parallels between the story of Isaac and the story of Christ. Christ seeking his bride, particularly from John 4, Christ seeking his bride at the well. Today, we'll look at the second half of this chapter, and then we'll go all the way down to the middle of chapter 30. And in this section, Genesis 29, Jacob's about to get a lesson in bait and switch, only you know, this time it's not, you know, like a television commercial or something like we would encounter, but something a lot more important, a wife, as we'll see in a minute. but Jacob thinks he's getting one thing only to find out that he doesn't get what he'd been promised. And the whole story continues the theme of the bride. And before we get started, let me just remind you that we are a podcast of the Reformed Forum, and you can learn more about the Reformed Forum, of course, at reformedforum.org, where you can see the various podcasts of the forum, such as Christ the Centers, the Theology Simply Profound, and of course the Reformed Forum Academy, where you can enroll in a number of courses from an introduction to the theology and apologetics of Cornelius Van Til to the Westminster Shorter Catechism, which I believe is taught by our own Jim Cassidy, who's taking us through the book of Hosea. So check out reformedforum.org. And Robert, remind us again. I know you told us in the previous episode you've had a switch in where you are. In fact, in terms of geography, quite a switch, but also in terms of your role. Where are you now?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. It is quite a switch. We were in Houston, Texas for eight total years. And then back in November of 2020, I was called as the pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church, OPC congregation, here in Beaver Creek, Ohio. Beaver Creek is a suburb of Dayton. Dayton would be the, I guess, the most well-known city. But we're in Beaver Creek, and my family moved to the area right around that time and have been pastoring and ministering on the Lord. I was at Reformed Theological Seminary for the last 2 years in Houston. But my heart and the burden was to be in the local church, preaching Christ, shepherding God's people, which is what, by God's grace, I'm doing now. And it's a wonderful, sweet congregation. They've been very kind, welcoming my family. The Lord's doing some wonderful things. And so if any of our listeners are in the Southern Ohio area, or in the broader Dayton region, or even maybe in the Beaver Creek area, we'd love to have you come worship with us as we worship our Savior.
Well, and it's great to have you back in pastoral, regular, full pastoral work. You're a good preacher, and we need good preachers. Yeah, I guess that's something about preaching, right, Robert? We're having a podcast on preaching, and I think maybe you can just talk about this for just a moment. First, did you miss preaching? You know, I think that, you know, when I go away on vacation, let's say, for more than a week or two, I need to get back. I need to preach the gospel. And I don't know how I would do if I stepped away for a couple of years, but you've been preaching for several years. So what brought you back?
No, thanks. That's a That's the question. Sometimes, we think of what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. When I was serving at RTS, it was a wonderful privilege and a great blessing. I have many dear friends and colleagues with whom I was serving. I am, like you, a graduate of RTS, and so that opportunity opened up, and it was a blessing. I just serve in the academy. We here at Reform Forum obviously strongly believe in growing in grace and having an educated ministry. And when I was serving as director there in Houston, I would be preaching fairly regularly. More often than not, I would be preaching at various church plants, churches in the area. But even then, and you, I'm sure you're familiar with this, there's still something different about that, which is wonderful, and then preaching to your own congregation that you know. That you are shepherding, as shepherds, we are called to know our sheep and to know their struggles and their concerns, their joys and their sorrows. And then to be preaching and walking through books of the Bible and proclaiming those great truths to those sheep that the Lord has put in our charge. So that when you're preaching on doctrine X, we know that this or that individual, this boy or girl or man or woman, is struggling with this issue. And there's a certain urgency, I think, to our preaching when we are in and with the flock week in and week out. And so while I did have the opportunities to preach while I was at RTS, it's a little bit different than what's well, quite a bit different than preaching to your own local congregation week in, week out, that you are walking with, that you are down in the Christian life with the blood, the sweat, and the tears. And during those couple of years out of the pulpit, the Lord was weighing that burden on my heart, that He, in His providence, would have me serve Him in the local church in regular pulpit ministry. And so thankful to be back and to be talking about actually preaching here on this podcast and with you today.
Well, I'm certainly glad you're back. There is a big difference between, conference preaching or occasion preaching and
Right.
preaching as a shepherd, preaching as part of your shepherding ministry.
There is, I think that's a good way to put it. I'm gonna call it occasional preaching versus, kind of the regular week in, week out shepherding ministry in the local church.
Right. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying that, and I know your people are benefiting from it greatly. Well, here we are in Genesis chapter 29, and we're going to start at verse 19, which kind of seems to put us kind of right in the middle of it. It's where we stopped last time, but it's over a certain point where Laban has just realized that Jacob's arrival. Laban has a pretty keen eye for a deal, and he. Jacob's arrival is not going to be followed by a caravan of riches. And so, he kind of goes from considering Jacob to be my bone and my flesh, to being my employee. He says, well, what should I pay you? And before Jacob answers, we're introduced to the fact that Laban has two daughters, the older one, Leah. We looked at that, how she's described. She seems to be rather dull looking, something about her eyes, they're not just, eh. But the younger one, Rachel, quite lovely. And Laban, being somebody with, keen eyes himself, certainly recognizes Jacob's attraction to his daughter Rachel, and also then, of course, recognizes an opportunity to enrich himself. So he suspects Jacob's willing to work for his younger daughter. He's already formulated a plan, but he's not the deal maker. He's not a negotiator. So he kind of blurts out, look, I'm willing to work 7 years in order to marry your daughter, Rachel. Gordon Wenham, in his commentary on this book on Genesis, or maybe he comments on this in another book, but at any rate, he comments on the fact that this is way more than Jacob would have needed to pay for a bride. It's kind of like going to a car dealer and looking at the window sticker and saying, you know what, I'll double it. At least he's not going to argue with you.
Right. Reminds me of what we often will tell our kids. You know, we'll kind of blurt out a promise to our kids, and they will never, ever let us forget that promise. So,
Right. You're real careful about, because they are real promises, aren't they?
right.
You are obligating yourself to something. And then, of course, you need to teach your children to keep their word. So, Jacob's kind of in a bit of a, getting himself in a bit of a jam, and we'll find out that it's a bigger jam than what it appears to be even now. So Jacob is tricked, and this is what you see in verses 20 through 27. Laban starts off by saying, you know, it's better that I give her to you than that I should give her to any other man. So stay with me. In other words, be my hired hand, and I'll pay you. Now, notice what Laban doesn't say. It's interesting, quite often in some of these narrative portions, you can really, well, you know, it's helpful sermon material, frankly, to notice what people don't say as much as what they do say. And you certainly see that in books like Judges. You know, they're coming into, you know, Joshua is another book, the conquest of Canaan. What isn't said is often as important as what is said. And Laban, in this case, he doesn't say, okay, I'll give you Rachel. He doesn't say that. He avoids a direct answer. He makes a general statement. I'd rather you have her than anyone else. Who is the antecedent to the pronoun there? Her? Doesn't actually say. So Jacob, you know, kind of shakes hands on the deal. No written contract here. And he hasn't had a lot of experience outside of his own household, and doesn't promise him a thing. So Jacob serves 7 years for Rachel. He loves her so much that it seems like a couple of days, verse 20. And the time comes now when Jacob demands his bride. And so in verse 22, Laban gathers all the people of the place. He makes a feast. The word feast is a word that speaks of drinking wine. Again, Wenham here helps us to understand this as kind of a drinking party. It goes on for a long time. Laban, like any conniving deal maker, is, you know, trying to make sure that the alcohol is flowing pretty freely. And then, but in the evening, I think the but there is emphatic. In verse 23, here's the bait and switch. He took his daughter Leah, brings her to Jacob, and he went into her. In the morning, you know, Jacob gets up, and behold, it was Leah, verse 25. We know the story. And, you know, imagine that, right? You go to bed with your wife, you know, you wake up the next morning, and, wow, he sees old weak eyes. You know, you know, not what he was anticipating. So,
no, I'm assuming not.
No. So, you know, Jacob's, we might be thinking, well, this guy's not very swift. I certainly would notice that. But, you know, you might remember a couple of things. Probably, the text doesn't say this, but I think it's implied that Jacob is probably rather drunk.
Yep.
Most commentators seem to agree that that was Laban's goal in this drinking party, that old, you know, funny joke about drinking and waking up next to somebody you don't know. Not so funny joke. That's a tragedy as old as Jacob. I don't know if this reminds any of our listeners about any stories maybe earlier in Genesis about a couple of girls who get somebody drunk and sleep with them.
It probably does. It probably does, in fact, you know, several chapters in the past.
Right, yeah. Lot's daughters did that very kind of thing. And you'd say, well, what kind of a disgusting man would engage in incest? Well, how about one that didn't have a clue what he was doing? And here's Jacob. He doesn't have his senses about him, probably. And he should, you know, also realize, of course, that during this entire ceremony, the bride is veiled. Her face is not seen. And then verse 23 makes the point of telling us that it's in the evening. It's under the cover of darkness that Leah is given to Jacob. He never sees her. And, of course, he's never been intimate with Rachel, so he doesn't know that it's not her. And so, you know, when you put these things together, I think it's very plausible here that this is not an embellishment of, you know, later Jewish commentators or something, as some people accuse of, you know, other parts of the Old Testament as being, you know, a later addition to embellish the story. This is really quite a plausible scene that the deceiver has been deceived.
Yep. I think also, Mark, you know, this is a good reminder that we see often in, especially in the Old Testament, and narratives, that these great patriarchs, you know, these heroes of the faith are, yes, raised up, sustained by God's grace for unique roles in history, but also they are sinners just like us. You know, they are sinful folks in flesh and blood living in a sinful world who often fall into great, great sin. And the Bible is a realistic book. I think we could put it that way.
Yeah, it certainly is. And there's a lot of exegetical detail that we're going to skip in trying to cover one chapter, you know, in 40 minutes or so. And a lot of the nuggets that are in here certainly bring that out. And we're not going to bring all of those out today. But boy, you can see Jacob's deception. There's certainly a lack, definitely a lack of appeal to God. It is really, it's quite astounding, actually. And I think it was Voss who said something to the effect, I won't get this exactly right, but something to the effect, you know, that in the patriarchs, the reprehensible characteristics are brought to the forefront. You know, we can see that it's God who's doing the work. Look at the antics of Abraham and his wife slash, you know, half sister. Look at some of Isaac's antics. We've already seen some of those, the way that he treats the children and the appeal to the flesh that we have. And Jacob isn't any different
right
at this point. So, but, you know, he's been tricked. And so, you know, the master deceiver has been deceived. And so he protests this trickery to Laban, who in return says to him in verse 27, well, complete the week of this one and we'll give you the other one in return for serving me another 7 years. That's kind of crass. yeah, thanks, Dad. But, you know, Jacob has no choice. And like it or not, he's married to Leah. He needs to fulfill his obligations. She's entitled to her week of celebration. It's thought that the 7-day creation week, you know, which brings forth life, is kind of the origin of this week-long marriage celebration. It's intended to bring forth life, right? It's an opportunity for the bride to conceive. And so Jacob tells Laban, you know, you take care of this, and then you can have Rachel, but you're going to need to work 7 more years if you want her. We can spend a lot of time on that, but we'll have to skip it. But the first set of 7 years Jacob serves, it seems like a few days, but interestingly, it doesn't say that about the second set of 7. You don't need much imagination to discern what an incredible amount of conflict and jealousy must have existed in this new household. This is like what vinegar and baking soda, right? You're sticking them together here, and not a good situation. In some ways, verse 30 states the obvious. We already know this, but it just tells us, in case we forgot, that Jacob loves Rachel more than Leah. You don't have to have a degree in family therapy, you know, to know that there's a problem.
But you do not. Yep.
Right. So Jacob's voluntarily put himself in a situation like this, which leads to significant conflict. And so the story of Isaac and Rebecca begins by Abraham's servant seeking God's guidance, and it ends with a beautiful wedding scene, you know, a banquet, the bride who can't wait to meet the groom, all of that. Story of Jacob is different. Here's a man who doesn't seek God's guidance. He never asks for God's guidance, doesn't trust in God's providence, takes matters into his own hands, and the result is not a joyous wedding celebration, but the hardship of sin's consequences. That's what we're looking at here. And that's really what happens then in down from here to almost the end of the section they're going to look at in verse 30, the consequences of man's deception, basically, and his conniving to get what he wants. So verses 31 through 35 talk about Jacob's children by Leah, about the anguish of Leah, who's a woman who's scorned. She's in shame because her husband is so willing to cast her aside for her sister. But God's going to take her shame. That's where we're going to go to the end of the story here. And he's going to bestow upon her glory. In the ancient Near East, the glory of a woman was her children. And, you know, Jacob may dishonor Leah, does not treat her well, but God bestows honor upon her. And Rachel remains unable to bear children. It's to Leah whom God, you know, gives 4 children then in rapid succession. And let's look at these first 4 children here. And in their naming, we see something of Leah's anguish. And these are names which will become familiar in the chapters ahead. And if you're preaching this, you know, there's so many different avenues that you could go with this, I think. But we'll just kind of walk through this very quickly, these names. But first, Reuben literally means behold a son, right? So she recognizes God's seen her. She hopes that because she's born a son to Jacob, that, well, look, I gave you a son. Now you'll love me. This is a woman who is scorned. The second son is Simeon. His name comes from a verb related to hearing, because God heard her cry, sees her anguish. Levi is the third. And this time she cries out that her hope is that her husband will be attracted to her now. The word is joined with her. It's a word that is used to describe a people joining a tribe or a person joining a family. And her heart is really crying out for her husband's love, for a stable family. Judah is the next child. And there seems to be a change of attitude here. It's not the voice of frustration. We don't hear now the cry of distress. It seems that in Judah, she turns to God and not trying to find her needs met in her husband, perhaps, but finding them met in God. He's the one who hears her. He's the one who sees her. He's the one who listens to her cry. He's the one who is extending honor to her, and he's the one who answers. So no longer are the naming of her children a cry of bitterness against Jacob, at this time, a voice that is opened in praise to Yahweh. She names her child Judah. I will praise Yah. I will praise Yahweh. So it's a beautiful, I think, testimony of God's perhaps work in her life. Of course, that's not explicit in the text, but I think you get that in the naming of these children. There's a bit of a progression here in her understanding and the foundation of her confidence.
Yeah. Mark, do you think, and I don't want to steal your thunder or where you're going to go down the line, but do you think there is something to the fact that Judah, which, you know, we know will be the tribe, you know, the promised tribe, we might say, that the tribe through whom Jesus will come, that Judah was born of Jacob and Leah, not Jacob and Rachel? Maybe I'm making too much of this, but typically we think of, you know, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Rachel. You know, just in our own heads, we often, right, that's how we think of it. But the son Judah was born of the one that Jacob loves least, we might say. You know, Jacob and Leah. Is there something to that? Maybe not. I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I think there is, in a sense. That is, I'm not sure. There's a great deal of significance to it, but I do think that Judah coming through Leah, what that's showing, because you have all these other children, and, you know, we're going to talk about the conflict that's born of them. What that's showing is, in a sense, what Judah's name means. I will praise Yahweh. So it's showing that God is the one who provides the promised seed, the promised line. It's not going to be through your conniving Jacob. It's not going to be through Leah and Rachel's a combative relationship here, their contest. It's through the original wife. It is through the one that, you know, is Jacob originally marries, that God provides the promised line. So I think the emphasis here, if there is one particularly, it's that this is God's doing. And of course, right, That's true of all of this, right? But I think particularly with Judah, we see that. And we'll see
that's
that
good.
A little bit more at the
that's
end,
good.
Too.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. Thanks.
And I think that's the idea too. Secondarily, if I may say, that it's through an outcast, it's through a rejected vessel that God brings forth the son, you know, from whom the Messiah is going to descend, the child of praise, you know, comes
right
through a rejected vessel.
Right.
And interesting, on Jacob's deathbed, you know, many years later, he would say that Judah's brothers will praise him. So, you know, that is the tribe, and we're going to see this later, of course, in Genesis, the tribe of Judah would become, you know, the predominant, preeminent tribe, and the nation of Israel, the tribe from which the scepter, the kingly reign of Judah, would never depart. You know, Judah does become the predominant one. David, Solomon, the kings, of course, all of the kings of Judah coming from that single line. And many years later, and here's what's interesting, another descendant of Judah, Isaiah, would prophesy of the coming Messiah and tell the people of Judah to look, for, and this is where it goes back to Leah, I think. Isaiah says, look for a man who has no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him, despised, rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, considered worthless by those who consider themselves worthwhile. You come to the New Testament, the beautiful people don't need Jesus. The self-righteous don't need Jesus.
Right, right.
But Isaiah says, this same Messiah bears the grief, the sins, carries the sorrows of his people, oppressed, afflicted, hated, cut off, and yet it was the will of the Lord to put him on a cross to bring salvation and eternal life. So I think there is significance in this. There's an echo in Leah, I think, of the Messiah. There is a picture of the downcast one from whom comes salvation.
Yeah, that's helpful.
I think that's a good point. But now, because Jacob hasn't sought God's counsel, he's kind of put himself in a situation which leads to conflict. And the end of the chapter speaks of the fact that Leah is hated. She was hated. It's a passive without an object. In other words, Leah is hated by everybody. Her father despises her because he's played her like a pawn. Jacob does because she got in the way of what he really wanted, which was Rachel. I mean, how do you think Leah feels? She's put to shame. Rather than being an honored wife, she becomes merely the object of Jacob's bitterness. But God honors her. When the Lord saw that Leah was hated, verse 31, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So these first four names, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, and really actually the first three, right, Levi, Simeon, Reuben, all named after her hopes that she'd be honored by her husband. The fourth child comes, this time I'll praise the Lord, and the chapter ends after Judah's born by telling us that she stops bearing children. Now, that heightens the tension at the end of the chapter because it doesn't seem as though God has closed her womb. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say God closed her womb because that's a kind of a frequent idea here. God opens and closes. But here, it's simply that she ceased bearing, which I think the implication is, I can't be certain of this, maybe somebody who's a better expert in this passage might be, but I think the implication here is that Jacob has ceased having a physical relationship with Leah. Maybe Rachel's putting too much pressure on him. She's getting mad because she doesn't have any children. Whatever it is, there doesn't seem to be much intimacy left there. And we get down to verse 14 of this chapter, and we'll see that in order to get a night with Jacob, she has to buy him. She has to hire him. So the chapter ends with even greater tension. So, we've got this bitter jealousy between the two wives. Rachel, is the favorite. Leah, who gives Jacob four children in a row, is hated. And so verse 30, or chapter 30 rather, then opens with the fact that Rachel envies Leah, puts pressure on Jacob to concentrate, look more on me, pay more attention to me, I'm the one you love, and less on, my homely sister with the weak eyes. And so it seems that he's staying away from Leah. And then chapter 30 is a chapter which emphasizes increase, even in the midst of this horrific conflict, which up to this point really is kind of tame compared to what we're about to see. And I think what we're seeing through all of this is, we've mentioned this before just a moment, but the people of God, and going back to the reprehensible characteristics of these people, this conflict, people of God have no noble origins in themselves. What's true of the patriarchs is true of the apostles, and it's true of us. But God takes the dissonance of a desperate people, and from it forms a legitimate, harmonious, heavenly family. And that's what I think this passage is saying. Maybe I should have stated that at the very beginning, but that's what I think this passage is leading us to. God's taking the dissonance of a desperate people and forms a legitimate, harmonious, heavenly family from it. Out of this, of course, is going to come ultimately the church. Now, to move on through chapter 30, and again, we're going to skip a lot of detail here. You probably know the story, but there's a lot of great exegetical nuggets that you could dig out, but we'll just mention a few of them. But in the first half of chapter 30, God blesses Jacob's family, and with reproduction. The second half of the chapter, God bless us, is fortune. And we're not going to get to that part today, but both of these are gifts in the hand of God. So today we're just going to look at how God increases the family down to verse 34, and we're going to see some children by desperation first here, where Rachel sees the shame of being childless, which again, in the ancient Near East, that's a big problem. The measure of your worth is your children, how many of them for a woman. And not only does Leah have her husband, but Leah, who was never supposed to be part of this picture anyway, has all the children. But just like Jacob, interestingly, Rachel does not cry out to God for help. It's one of the things that this section, by the way, in this little pericope from 19 down to 24 of chapter 30, it kind of reminds me of the book of Esther. In the book of Esther, God is absent. And he's not absent just because it's a literary detail. He's absent because he's absent in the thinking of the Jews. He's not mentioned because they don't think about him. They're following Jewish customs. They're doing Jewish stuff. But, you know, they're following part of the cult of the religious Israel. But God isn't there because they're not thinking about him. And that's kind of what's happening here. Interestingly, by the way, Esther is described in the same way as Rachel is described. I think there's correspondence there in terms of the way that God works in spite of Esther and in spite of Rachel. But anyway, Rachel doesn't go to God in prayer. She takes a page from the playbook of Aunt Rebecca, who twice had used the phrase, "What good will my life be to me?" You know, when she's trying to manipulate Isaac. And she tells Jacob, verse 1, "Give me children or I shall die." And Jacob's response is like the classic example of trying to remove the splinter out of your friend's eye, ignoring the log in your own. His anger's kindled against Rachel. of course, right? It's her fault. That maybe reminds us of something back all the way in, chapter 1, the woman that you gave me.
It's the woman's fault.
Right, yeah. God, you know, God, it's your fault. Jacob says, it's the wife's fault. He says, "Am I in the place of God who's withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" He's pretty quick to rebuke Rachel for not, you know, asking God for children, but he never intercedes on her behalf. You don't see him pleading with God. So in verse 3, Rachel says, "Look, I have an idea. Let me give you my servant, and she'll give you a surrogate child. Bilhah, the servant, right?" The arrangement anyway that they make. Some laws in the ancient Near East required that a wife would provide a slave to the husband if she didn't bear children. Rachel seems to be following this. And what we're looking at here, frankly, is that they've adopted pagan customs. You know, this is what they do around us, so this is what I'll do for you. Look, here, you can have my servant and have children by her. And this is his chance to say, no, that's not how we do things. But Jacob's not living as a pilgrim, or he's living as a pagan. His conscience has absorbed the morality of the world around him, and so he goes into Bilhah. She conceives a son, Dan, which means to judge. So Rachel feels vindicated. God, you know, he must have judged my situation and given me children. Dan doesn't turn out to be a real hero in the halls of Israelite history. He has another child with Bilhah. Rachel names him Naphtali, which means wrestling. And maybe that's characteristic of the ongoing struggle here. I've got one over on Leah. I've given her a good right hook, you know, so I'm going to name my child Wrestle, kind of thing. And then in verse 9, we see Leah stops bearing children. So she says, I can't stand for this. So she gives Jacob her servant Zilpah. And by the way, there's a lot of intrigue in the middle of all this. I'm kind of rushing through it. The child by her, she names Gad. The Torah commentary, interestingly, the child by Zilpah, Leah's servant, the Torah, the Jewish commentary, points out that Gad is the name of the God of good luck. He's mentioned in Isaiah 65, when the prophet says to Judah, "You've forsaken Yahweh, instead you've set a table for the God of fortune. You've set a table for Gad." Many towns in the ancient Near East were called by this name, Baal Gad, Midgal Gad, because, you know, the idea was maybe the gods will bring us good luck. So I think what we're looking at here, again, it's just somewhat parallel to the book of Esther here, the absence of the recognition of God's providence, and yet he's at work in all of this. and blessings are attributed to good luck and chance and happenstance and so on. Verse 13, we have a second son through Zilpah, Asher, a name which phonetically sounds like one of the Hebrew words for being happy. And so I think we're seeing Leah's getting happy again, you know, that now I'm winning the battle, you know, kind of thing. And it brings us down to verses 14 through 21. And here I want to slow down just a little bit. I've kind of been rushing. But I want to slow down and see how this little vignette in 14 to 21 of chapter 30 illustrates and magnifies the conflict. It just shows you how bad things have gotten here. So if you look at verse 14, it's around harvest time. Reuben's in the field, brings home some mandrakes, brings them to Leah. Rachel sees them, and she wants them. And Rachel really wants them. So she wants these mandrakes bad enough to exchange a night in bed with Jacob in order to get them. So, you know, you look and say, wow, she must really like mandrakes. Well, what in the world is it about mandrakes? Well, it was another superstition. So here's some more luck. Superstition again. This is what is overarching throughout all of this, is superstition, luck, human manipulation, and yet God's providence superseding all of this, really behind the scenes in a way that Jacob doesn't anticipate. But anyway, the word for mandrakes sounds somewhat similar to the word for love, and it was thought that a mandrake, both physically and chemically, it seemed to mimic and maybe even produce an erotic sensation, kind of like an aphrodisiac. They're even talked about in the Song of Solomon. But this is all superstition, and Rachel sees that Leah has them. And so, oh no, you know, Leah has another trump card. She's got an aphrodisiac. She wants some for herself. And that's why Leah gets so upset, because she knows why Rachel wants them. And that's why she says, is it a little thing that you've taken away my husband? Will you take away my son's mandrakes too? But in the long run, yeah, she is. She's willing to trade a night in bed with Jacob to get her hands on them. Remember, she still has no children of her own. And so she needs to do whatever it takes, kind of thing. So Leah agrees to the transaction. And for her, the mandrakes work, not by making a love potion out of them, which is what they would often do, but they work by selling them to Rachel. So she buys Jacob. And this is just disgusting when you think about it. But in verse 16, Jacob came home from the field in the evening. You know, he's done working in the field. He's all sweaty and just, I just want to lay down and take a nap. Leah goes out to meet him and says, you must come in to me, for I've hired you with my son's mandrakes. You think about this for a minute. What has Jacob been reduced to? The four times in the next three verses, the word hire or wage is used. Jacob, basically, you can see what the marriage has come to. A wealthy man is reduced to simply, and one commentator puts it this way, rightly and frankly, I think, he's been reduced to stud material. He's just a machine to produce babies, to gratify their need. He's basically a male prostitute within his own home. I've bought you. You lay with me. And so he did, right? It says then, so he lay with her that night. Now, we can't avoid this if we want to exegete the text responsibly. That's why I'm kind of slowing down on this little vignette. The NIV translates it, he slept with her. And you see the expression again in verse 15. It's kind of a crass way of saying it. You know, back in the 90s, again, just to be, it's kind of crass, but that's the way the biblical text reads here. It's basically, you know, back in the 90s, yeah, I had sex with her. And that's how crass this is. I don't think people say it quite like that anymore. But that's the kind of language that's being used, because Bruce Waltke points out in his commentary that this kind of language is never used to speak about an appropriate marriage relationship. It only speaks about adultery or rape. It's used to speak of Lot and his daughters. It's used to speak of what the Philistines wanted to do to Rebecca a couple of chapters ago. It's going to be used a few chapters from now to speak about how Leah's daughter's violated. That's basically what's going on here. And there's not a lot of love. And that's all going to come into play when the children grow up, of course. Think of the story of Joseph, right? A little bit later on. These aren't brothers who are really, you know, tight. But I want you to see what God does with this. God sees their anguish, this gut-wrenching hurt, and he reaches out to them in mercy. Verse 17 and 18. God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. And Leah said, God's given me my wages because I gave my servant to my husband. So she called his name Issachar, which means a reward. She thinks she's being rewarded by God. The word here, by the way, is generic, Elohim, which could very well mean the gods. Just good luck. You know, God gave me this, the great one out there, you know, gave me this to Jacob. At some level, now whether or not this is a believing expression of a believing faith, I think it's kind of hard to tell, but again, it's very generic. But at some level, she's starting at least to recognize that this child isn't because of her clever manipulation, but comes from the hand of God. Forget the mandrakes. And it seems that maybe God's at work. And then in verse 19 to 20, she has another son, and she seems to indicate that she's blessed by God, names him Zebulun. It's related to word honor. Again, the idea, maybe my husband will honor me. And then she bears a daughter, verse 21, Dinah, the only daughter of Jacob that's named in Genesis. And of course, the name is given to us here in the middle of all of this conflict to set us up for the fact that in chapter 24, we're going to see some more. In other words, and here's a point of application, you know, Robert, I think that we can make here. There's tons of points of application, by the way, in this passage that you can make. I mean, everything from family life to being faithful, not being deceptive, seeking the Lord, lots of points of deception. But here's one of, or application rather, but here's one of them. And that is that the seeds of sin aren't sown in a vacuum.
Right.
They're sown in the soil of self-sufficiency. They're watered by self-indulgence, and they make a big mess.
I mean, you're so right, Mark. I mean, as you're saying that, I couldn't help but go back to back in the story of Abraham. You know, the Abraham, Sarah, Hagar, and the sin that comes in there. And you know, you covered this a while back, but you know, what do you see in that household, in that particular episode, the Hagar, Sarah, Abraham? Well, it's just a big, huge mess. They're all filled with anger and envy and hatred. No one sins on an island, as you were, you know, helpfully reminding us of.
Right. Absolutely. And that there's so much application here. And typically in a passage this long, you're not going to preach it all in one, you know, sermon. I'm trying to give you just some of the overall theme of it. But you can really break it down into some of the, you know, the important points of application, and that's certainly one of them. And there is, I think, a deliberate echo, of course, of Abraham and Hagar and his situation with his family and some of that conflict. But this is a home that's filled with conflict, and it's not just here, but as the children grow. And again, there's a point of application as well. Your children are going to amplify what they see in the home. And Jacob and Leah and Rachel all thought they were fixing a problem when what they're doing is creating one. And we're going to see a lot more. This is really setting the groundwork for some of the conflict in the chapters ahead. Five chapters from now, we're going to see that Leah's firstborn, Reuben, begins to lust after Rachel's servant, Bilhah, who's in this chapter, of course. And no sooner does Rachel die than Reuben violates Bilhah. And Jacob takes his grief to the grave. He takes Bilhah, and again, Bilhah, again, we see that phrase, he lay with her, same phrase, and it's a disgrace and a grief to his father, because Bilhah, of course, was technically his father's wife. That's how the Bible presents it. But for Reuben, it represents a triumph, because the two children born by Bilhah, Dan and Naphtali, belong to Jacob's Rachel, were rivals to Reuben's position of preeminence as firstborn, right? Reuben's firstborn of Rachel, but Bilhah's children are the firstborn technically of Leah, so they're rivals of Reuben. So this whole thing is a rivalry that ends in death. It's kind of a crazy thing. But I want to fast forward now just a bit and get down to the end of the section here, verses 20 through 24, and talk a bit about what happens next, which is different. Something different now is going to happen. And a child is going to be born not from manipulation or desperation or obligation, but a child by, just to keep our alliteration sort of going here, by divine operation. Rachel conceives, And so in verse 22, and as we get to the end here, 20 through 24, God remembered Rachel, God listened to her and opened her womb. Interesting that God remembered Rachel. I don't think he'd forgotten her. We've seen that word before in covenant. It's related to covenant promises. And we glean from that that in spite of all of this mess, Rachel is a covenant member. She's one of God's people. And she seems to have forsaken him, but he has not forsaken her. Her heart is filled with anguish. Her trust has been in what she can accomplish. How can she know joy? How can she know happiness? Only through the mercy of God. She conceives and bears a son, verse 23, says, God has taken away my reproach. She bears Joseph, whose name means, here's a twist, Yahweh has added. Oh, God is at work here. And then, may the Lord add to me another son. So Joseph now comes. Now, the story of Joseph is going to start in chapter 37. And then it's going to take up the last third of the book of Genesis. So here we see the beginning of what Genesis ultimately is leading to. And then it's only God can take away her disgrace. God takes away her disgrace, adds to her honor. And so the section ends with the action of Yahweh, who's pretty much been, other than the fact that it's God who's orchestrating all of this, we know that, but at least in terms of the perspective of the participants, the human participants, God's been absent. They've relied on trickery, superstition, deception, but it ends with God. And the section began in 29:31 when it says, Yahweh saw that Leah was hated and opened her womb. It ends by saying, may Yahweh add to me another son, which, of course, is the prophetic expectation of Benjamin. But the whole story begins and ends with the name, the personal name of the covenant-keeping God.
You were bringing out all those wonderful nuggets of truth. I couldn't help but be reminded of, and you mentioned this just a couple minutes ago, and I don't want to dwell on this too long at all, is the contrasting pictures of the two wedding slash family scenes that we see in Genesis 24, Isaac, Isaac and Rebecca, just this beautiful scene. Isaac's servant prays to the Lord on multiple occasions, and there's that beautiful, as you put, kind of wedding scene there at the end, contrasted with this chapter. As you've been walking us through it so helpfully, is just filled with division, with envy, with sin. Yet through it all, in spite of and working through, the sin of these individuals, God is doing a great thing, and He is keeping His promise, fulfilling His promise, and growing His people, growing the covenant community. It's quite stunning to see the contrast and then to see how the Lord works in spite of our sin.
Right. Yeah, and what's interesting is too is the multiplication of our sin and its further consequences. And one of the things we saw about Isaac, he has this beautiful wedding and things are great. One of the things we saw about him that was so clear is that he's a man that lives by his fleshly material instincts. Mm-hmm. Give me food. Go get the stuff, kind of thing. And Jacob takes that and it's like, magnifies that. He orchestrates this whole thing. He's not seeking God's face. And yet God works. He overrules all of this for His glory and our good. Of course, all of this is serving the purposes of redemption. So let's kind of wrap this up. And what are we seeing here? The overwhelming theme, I think, that's here is barrenness and fruitfulness that comes by God. The focus is on Rachel. We wait the whole chapter. Now, she waits years and years. We were employs many efforts on her part before. It's God at this. God takes hopelessness. God takes jealousy. Here's another point of application. Transforms. Forms it through His sovereignty in people's lives. Think about that, for example, in the life of Augustine. God takes his decadence, his sinfulness, transforms it by his sovereignty, that Augustine plays a major part, doesn't he, in the story of redemption. Is probably one of the greatest, or at least one of the greatest theologians of the church has ever known. Even Augustine's foray into things like Manichaeism, Neoplatonism, God uses elements of that he learned, not doesn't use elements of it, but he uses what Augustine learns through those forays into, well, paganism and false philosophy, to transform him into one of the greatest theologians of the church. And that's what he does in us. That's what he does in our hearts. That's what he does with his people. That's what he does for the church as he beautifies his bride. So this picture of being barren, unable to bear children, it becomes prominent in the Old Testament. And it's a picture of what God does for his people. And it represents the fact that God can take a barren desert and turn it into a fruitful orchard, right? That's what the prophets talked about. The desert's going to sing for joy. It's going to be flowers in the desert, the streams on the desert. Hannah, think of Hannah, 1 Samuel 2, what God did for her. Barren brings forth Samuel, who leads the people of Israel, who gives them the hope of the gospel. Isaiah speaks to God's people who are scattered and captive, without hope, without a home, without a dwelling place. He compares them to a barren woman, but then tells them, burst into song because the Lord will give life. Isaiah 54. And I think there's some back and forth reference here. Sing, O barren one who did not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, you who have not been in labor. For the children of the desolate one will be more than the children of her who is married, says the Lord. And what's Isaiah talking about? He's talking about God's people. He's talking about, ultimately, I think, the church. Galatians 4, Paul writes, Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all. For it is written, rejoice, O barren one, going back to Isaiah 54, which I think is, by implication, at least an allusion to what we're reading about here in Genesis chapter 30. Rejoice, O barren one who does not bear, break forth and cry aloud, you who are not in labor, for the children of the desolate one will be more than those of the one who has a husband. When we saw that, you mentioned that earlier, Robert, the story of Sarah and Hagar, how Sarah is parallel, the story here, to that of Rachel. And back there, when we looked at Sarah and Hagar, we saw that Paul picks up on this in Galatians 4, speaks of the church of Jesus Christ. And Paul says to the Judaizers, look, you're doing nothing more than trying to claim the promises of grace through the mechanism of the law. You Judaizers are nothing more than slaves. Like Hagar, we might say, like Bilhah, like Zilpah. You're not true Jews. The Jerusalem that we belong to, the Jerusalem above, Paul says, is free, and she is our mother. And Paul's saying that the church is the spiritual Jerusalem. The promises given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they're going to branch out, not be for Jews only, but for all of those who united in the seed of Abraham, Jesus Christ. And I think that's what all of this is leading up to, the barren woman blessed with many sons and daughters. Now, how does that happen? It happens by God fulfilling his covenant to Abraham, that in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed, that through his offspring, Jesus Christ, the Gentiles will be brought in. From Abraham's lifelessness, God brings forth life, right? From Sarah's barrenness, God brings forth a son. The story is repeated in Rachel. What's happening? In the midst of all of the maladies and malfunctions of human effort, God's fulfilling his covenant. And what we're going to see as we get through the rest of this particular section up to the story of Joseph, and even into the story of Joseph, is that things don't get any better. The children of Israel wandering in the wilderness as they read this, they're noting the birth of Joseph in the beginning of the story. You think that catches their eye. Oh, Joseph, is born. He's eventually going to, be the reason why they go to Egypt, from which they've been delivered, the reminder of their promises. One other thing. And then I'll stop, because there's a lot here, as you can tell. I tried to pack one chapter into one episode. But I just want to mention one other thing. When you get to the Gospels, Luke chapter 1, for example, the announcement that what the prophets had been talking about, the coming of the promised offspring who would deliver God's people, right? That is being fulfilled. And what's interesting is early on in Luke's Gospel, Luke is the one who concentrates on this, we find the same theme of barrenness. A woman who can't bear a child, Elizabeth, the mother of John the prophet. She's barren. She suffers shame and reproach. But at the end, she echoes the words of Rachel in Genesis 30 and verse 23 when she says, God has taken away my reproach. One of the things, one of the keys, of course, to preaching through any Old Testament passage, obviously, it should almost go without saying, right, is whenever a passage is quoted in the New Testament from the Old, you've got to make reference to that. You've got to make that connection. And folks, if you don't have that wonderful tool, the commentary of the New Testament use of the Old Testament, I think that's by Beal and Carson. If you don't have that book, you need to run right now, pause the podcast, get the book, come back. It's available in Logos as well, which I would recommend even more because it's a big, giant book with a very large index with tiny, tiny print. So Logos would be more useful. Get that, right? Because you've got to see these connections. And here we see one, the barren Elizabeth. Elizabeth brings forth John, who announces the Messiah, who fulfilled the promises of the covenant to Abraham, fulfills the promises of these, of the, this whole section that we're reading, the one who would take a collection of broken, sinful, selfish people from a dubious lineage, there's no doubt, as we read this, and bring them into an authentic family through union with himself and his work on the cross. This dysfunctional human family brought into intimate association with God because he is God dwelling with us in a way that Rachel and Leah could only dream about. And so, yeah.
It's just a beautiful picture. My only comment was just, you know, just a beautiful picture of God's grace that we see on every page of his word.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is wreck of a story.
Right.
Dysfunctional household, right, is right in the path of the course of the history of redemption. We see the birth of these 12 children, which, of course, are, you know, most of the 12 tribes of Israel, a picture, a type of the church. They're mirrored in the 12 apostles whom Jesus selects, sovereignly brings them out, collects them, makes them his children, this odd assembly of disciples, most of whom were unknowns, those who we know something about were not laudable, fisherman, tax collector, one of them's a traitor, to prove himself not really to be one of them. The church was built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. So, you know, one last point of application. Christ is all through this, I mean, as you can see, I think. But one last point of application here, and then I guess I have to stop here. But the Church of Christ, you know, it's an interesting collection of people. But, you know, to be really frank about it, we're an interesting collection of misfits. And maladies and broken hearts and the low and the foolish and the weak and the despised. And if you think I'm being nasty, then, you know, go read 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Yeah, that's why we can't boast. Right, God takes these things, us, you know, like he took the broken hearts and scarred lives of Leah and Rachel, and he forms his very own people because he takes us to the foot of the cross.
That's the story of the Bible, right? So that we can't boast, you know, Psalm 115, you know, not unto us, but unto your name be the glory. We have nothing to boast about, which we see. I mean, this family has nothing to boast about at all, except their misfitness.
Right, exactly. Right. And yet God, you know, and these children, but they're a picture of the church, aren't they? They're a picture of God's work in his church through Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Yeah, brother, I mean, there are, you know, a myriad of ways that you can preach this passage, that you can break it down into sections. I kind of took one, you know, that's kind of large, I think, for a sermon. But I hope it makes us, you know, kind of think through what are some of the themes that can be brought out here, and how can Christ be seen? He's certainly seen. Yeah.
And thank you. That was excellent. Encouraging, edifying, and Christ exalting.
Praise the Lord. Well, my name is Mark Winder, pastor of Wolf River Presbyterian Church in Collierville, Tennessee. We meet at 9:30 in Collierville on Sunday mornings. And you can also find us online at wolfriverchurch.org. And Robert, where can our listeners find out more about you?
If you're in the Dayton area, the Beaver Creek area. We'd love to have you come worship with us. Our website is daytonopc.org, daytonopc.org. Again, we'd love to have you come worship with us if you are in the area.
And remember, we are a podcast of the Reformed Forum, reformedforum.org. We encourage you to go online there and see what they've got. All kinds of cool things, including the Reformed Forum store, where you can buy yourself a Calvin wine glass, stemless wine glass, so that it won't get broken very easily. You can get yourself one of those things, as well as your Machen Challenge coin. Nobody's ever challenged me for one of those yet, but I better stick one in my pocket. But at any rate, you can go online and find out more about that. And also encourage you to give to the work of the Reform Forum if you are able. Reformforum.org/donate. Thank you for listening to Proclaim.